After years on the road, Timmy parked the van and picked up the mic to bring you this podcast that features interviews with people from hardcore to hair metal. This is Talk To Me with your host, Joshua Toomey.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Talk To Me, episode 32. On this episode, I talked to James Morris of Downset. Such a great guest to have on the podcast, so let's get some business out of the way and so we can get to the podcast as soon as possible. Thanks to everyone who's been going and purchasing Talk To Me t-shirts on Amazon.com. Make sure to head on over to Amazon.com. Pick yourself up a Talk To Me t-shirt. Only 20 bucks. They come in men's sizes, women's sizes. You can even get them in kid sizes. So thanks to everybody who's been checking those out and picking them up. Obviously, you can tell we got a new intro on the podcast, and that was made possible by you guys supporting the podcast and picking up those t-shirts. Also, another way, another great way to support the podcast is make sure to go over to iTunes, rate and review the podcast, subscribe to the podcast, and let everybody know that you're listening to the podcast. It's pretty crazy. I've got like 50,000 downloads of this podcast, and I have like 3 reviews on iTunes. So I need everybody to go over there right now, pause the podcast, do whatever you got to do, search out the Talk To Me podcast on iTunes, rate and review the podcast, and I want to read those. Read the new ones on the next week's episode of the podcast. Next week's episode is going to be another huge episode. I've already got the guest lined up, recorded, ready to go, and I will be telling you guys about that at the end of this podcast. Make sure you're going over to facebook.com/talktometalk. Always hit us up on Twitter at talktometalk. And then if you need to email the show directly, it's talktometalk@gmail.com. When these podcasts come out, I put them on my personal page, which is just facebook.com/joshua.toomey. You can always just add me as a friend. You're going to see so much more of my personal life plus the podcast stuff. So I share them there, share them on the Talk To Me page, share them on the Talk To Me Twitter. So make sure you're checking those places out so you know who's coming up on the podcast. And when you see those things, please hit that share button. Share with your friends the podcast. I'm going to start reading off the names of the people who share the podcast. And I want you guys to be on there each and every week. So, yes, I stole that from another podcast. And I will say it's an homage to another podcast. Share the podcast once you see it pop up. And let's get as many people as we can listening and downloading the Talk To Me podcast. Back to the guest of honor this week, though, James Morris of Downset fame. We talk a little bit about Social Justice, the band that was precursor to Downset. We talk about Inside Out, his thoughts on Rage Against the Machine, Tim Comerford's bass playing, their touring with Biohazard and Pantera, his thoughts on the whole Phil Anselmo nonsense, you know, and then I do ask him the question of how he feels about kind of being one of the first rap metal slash new metal bands out there and all the bands that kind of spawned from those bands. So pretty great, you know, great answer and super positive guy. Great to have him on the podcast. So without any further ado, I'm going to play you some Downset and then get you right into this interview. And I hope you guys enjoy it. And I will see you guys on the other side.
Anger, hostility towards the opposition. 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 Anger, hostility towards the opposition.
Field if you ain't got no fucking heart, cause Willie kind of want to start out with a story for you. Years and years ago, back in the it's either 99 or 2000. I can't remember which year it was. But we played. I had this band in Nashville, and we got offered a show to open for you guys in Tempe, Arizona. We had routed some dates to Arizona, but they all fell through, and we were all like 19, 20 years old. And we sat there and we're like, should we do it? Should we not do it? Should we do it? And I was like, you know, fuck it. And we just loaded up the van and drove like 40 hours to open for you guys at a place called Boston's in Tempe, Arizona.
Wow, that was a great club. That's a great story, man. 40 hours just to play with the Hunter, man.
Yeah.
Wow,
it was Downset and Drown, and I was actually a big fan of Drown in high school, so I was like, that's a double whammy right there for me.
Wow, well, thank you for doing that. That must have been, looking back, probably a great adventure for you, though, right?
It was cool, man. We got out there and we got there so early that we actually went to the Grand Canyon, and like all of us piled out of the van and wandered around and, you know, brushed our teeth in the water fountain at the Grand Canyon, stuff like that.
See, that's a great story. I love that. That's awesome.
Wow. Yeah, and then the other one nice thing is as I play bass, and like there was, we opened the show and there was really nobody there. It was kind of a festival type deal, and
I remember that. That's the one where I broke the stage at the end.
Yeah, you actually came up to me after the show and you're like, man, it's really nice to see some talent. And I've kept that like in my brain like since then. It was pretty awesome, man.
That's awesome, man. Thank you so much. Yeah, well, then you're obviously a very good bass player.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but you know, it was nice to go out there, even though we didn't play for a lot of people. It was nice to have you say those kind comments. So,
well, awesome, man. It's nice to come full circle these many years later and then hear from you again. It brings back like a side of that experience that, you know, I have in my mind to hear you recount it, and it's sort of, you get to see it through a different lens or hear about it through a different sort of set of circumstances, and it just kind of brings my own experience with that whole show and that time and, you know, the band, and it just brings a bunch of feelings flooding back and a bunch of memories coming through, and so that's cool. Thank you for sharing that, and thanks for, you know, because, you know, I go through my daily life and you don't think about certain things and certain things you forget about. And I hadn't thought about that show in a long time, and hearing about it now from you is really cool. So thanks for driving 40 hours all the way up to Arizona and brushing your teeth in the Grand Canyon water fountain. And that's really cool.
You know, it was an adventure, but it was, you know, when you're in your early 20s, late teens, early 20s, you know, that's what makes music fun.
Yeah, that's a total adventure. Like, we're talking really essentially pre-internet and pre-cell phone for the most part, and you're just getting in a van analog style, you know, and you're just jamming across the country in a van with your band, and it's kind of the end of an era, I think, for a lot of that kind of just get out there and have an adventure. Like, everything is now, like, watched, and everything's, you know, on the grid, essentially, and just back in those days when no one could reach you and no one knew where you were unless you called in from a payphone, you know, and all those memories were insular rather than, you know, outward and discovered every minute, like on YouTube or something. You know, it's a cool memory. I'm glad you went out and did that and had fun.
It was a fun show, man. I remember the other thing too is was Ray had like a tape. I think I have this on tape. He has like a cassette recorder, and he keeps like doing something about Nike. It was like a Nike speech talking about how they don't pay anybody to make their shoes and stuff like that, but he kept like rewinding it and playing parts of it and over, and it was like early sampling, you know, but it was just like him with like a little tape recorder.
Yeah, all good. Yeah, so looking back now, it was, you know, on the cuff, just seat of the pants. So much of it was just, you know, still, you know, the fire in the belly with what you were passionate about, and you figured out ways to make it work. It was inspired stuff.
The first time I ever saw you, actually, you guys opened for Machine Head in, I believe, in Nashville, and we were at the show, and like at the beginning of Anger, you know, you play that bass line kind of by yourself, and you know, and like there was like no click track, no nothing going on, you know, it was just straight, you know, you playing by yourself, but you were like rocking out the entire time, and you know, being, I guess I was maybe 16, 17 at that time, and just like watching you play, it was very very inspiring. It was very good stuff, man.
Oh, thank you so much. Wow, that's, you know, very touching. I appreciate that. Yeah, thank you.
So then I'll get you all buttered up for the podcast. And
yeah, I'm all warm and fuzzy now.
So, yeah. Man, just kind of take me back to, like, the early days of Downset. You know, how did you guys come together?
Downset is formed from, like, the Los Angeles punk rock and hip-hop and graffiti art scene. Something that, when I was in high school, I was able, like, I started playing bass and playing punk rock, and I found punk rock, and it sort of became everything I was into, skateboarding and punk rock. And there was a band out here in the San Fernando Valley called Social Justice that quickly became my favorite band. And I loved them because they were from my, you know, the Valley. They weren't from Huntington Beach, or they weren't from, you know, Hollywood. They were a bunch of scrappy kids from right around the neighborhood. And I just found that to be amazing. And I loved their record. They put out a record with Brett from Bad Religion, started a small thing called Safe Side Records. And they had a 12-inch out. It absolutely played the hell out of. And it just so happened that the community was so small that I ended up playing bass for Social Justice. And it was like, I thought at that point my dream had come true. Right. I was playing in my favorite hardcore band, and we were playing big backyard shows and playing, you know, at all these spots around L.A. and Southern California. And I thought it was the best thing in the whole world. And then it just evolved all through high school, and then shortly after high school, there was a lot more sort of hip-hop coming into it, and a lot of more sort of just elements of that, like heavier elements, but mixed with more hip-hop elements via Ray, our singer. And yeah. it just sort of happened. And once things started to perk up, all of a sudden people were coming around talking about, you know, the record, a contract and signing, and things were getting much bigger in a very rapid way. And it had to do with the sort of entirely environment at the time. I think bands like Rage Against the Machine were just sort of starting to make noise. And back then, that whole scene, I think everyone thought it was going to be the next grunge. Like, all of a sudden, it was like, okay, what's next? Everyone, like, on the corporate side of thing, record label side of thing, was like, what's going to be the next grunge? And along came sort of like hardcore with hip-hop, and you had sort of that burst in 92, 93, when it was like Rage Against the Machine and Downset and all these other bands like from LA that were just starting to make noise. And we just got signed to Mercury Records. They you know, signed us, and we started making records, and off we went, like straight out of high school, basically. looking back, it was I didn't think past one day in front of me. And I was just able to play bass. I was just loving the fact that every day I could go out there and just play the hell out of the bass. And I think that's what I learned who I was as a bass player, was inside that band and playing those songs, because I don't think I really had an identity up until that point. And maybe even quite a bit through that point, you wonder, like, you know, is it good? If people like it, but am I good? And I think, you know, just being on the front lines of being in a professional quote-unquote band, you learned your craft, or you better, because you do it. Do it all the time.
You know, in Downset, I think you have a lot of freedom in Downset, to where you could, you know, you could go on these bass lines and bass runs, you know, under the music, and even, you know, being the quote-unquote, you know, main part of the riff. You know, you were a huge part of Downset.
Absolutely. We all wrote, we all contributed. It was basically a riff farm when we would get together. It was just like harvesting riffs. Like, we come from, Downset, I love, like, Yeezer, Butler, and not Don, but Bill Ward's groove. And I always, because Downset was kind of put it in low gear and kind of got a little bit more groovy, I always listened and fell back on sort of like Yeezer's epics. And then the other side of the coin was, you know, Steve Ozzy. You know, like Joe Rouse, Steve Ozzy, who I just sort of wanted to have that heavy groove with, like, a solid line, but mixed with the sort of sensitivity and maybe the intellect of, like, Steve Ozzy's bass lines. And I sort of kind of wanted to meld the two. And in between all of that was just all the hardcore and the punk rock and the more... the energy of hardcore, basically, and the spirit of hardcore between all that. Absolutely. And I think one last thing on that, it goes, I had the, like you said, the freedom, because there was no template, really. So I was sort of not following anyone's lead when it came to bass playing on this kind of music. It was just like, okay, this is what it is. And looking back now, decades later, it is different. There is a style and yeah. a sort of ethos to it that I really am proud of. So, yeah.
So in those early days, and I could be wrong, and if I'm completely wrong, I'll cut this out of the podcast, but was Ray a part of Inside Out with Zach? For some reason, I've always heard that, but I couldn't find anything to back that up when I was doing research for this.
No, that's not true. Ray was Inside Out, Zach De La Rocha, and Vic, Orange County Hardcore. That is a groundbreaking band. There's no reason to cut that out of the podcast.
Yeah.
That's fine. It's just something that's not true. That band was groundbreaking.
Was it?
Inside Out, Zach, or something. And it kind of parallels our band, like Social Justice, Downset, Inside Out, you know, Rage. And it's not the same story across the field, but it is like a bunch of guys that come from the hardcore scene, and at least the singer primarily that comes from the hardcore scene, that they, you know, got a lot more into hip hop and sort of developed that whole sound and feel. And that's where you get, you know, just, you know, right time, right place, and you get Downset and you get Rage. But it definitely does come from that Social Justice / Inside Out, those two bands being in the same scene, in the same general vicinity, and kind of creating the same culture.
So with you guys kind of being in the same area and the same scene, same time frame, things like that, when you saw those guys kind of blowing up and kind of doing something similar, I mean, how did you feel about that?
I felt fine. There was never, for me, there was never anything but like, wow, are you kidding me? Like the kind of music I made in high school, like we're all good. Like they came up and we all came up at the same time, but they took off. Like,
yeah.
it went from 0 to 60, like, almost overnight. Like, all of a sudden, it was, like, us and Rage, and then, boom, Rage was just, had sort of staked the claim for, you know, like, rap and hardcore together. And I never saw it as anything but a great thing for music in general. I was never jealous or sort of that hateful type that, you know, F them, we're cool, and they took it and ran with it. So no, never any of that. I always was very happy to see that what I was doing was being successful.
You know, another thing too with this, those guys, you know, like Tim Comerford, such an amazing bass player too. You know,
yeah.
He had a lot of freedom in that band also. No, I guess no pun intended on that one, but.
I think he totally was outside the box when it came to bass playing.
Yeah.
I think all those guys in that band, sort of, you could isolate them and you would find something very interesting. I mean, Tim's bass playing was just a total, like, a total identity to that, the way he plays and the kind of accents and the groove he found on those beats. So simple and sparse, but with all the confidence in the world. And I think looking back as a bass player, I think one of my big overindulgences maybe is to play a fill where there doesn't need to be a fill, to sort of be like, all right, I just played that riff three times in a row. Here comes the fourth, and I'm going to do something else to bring it around. And I think with him, it was all just, he created the landscape for beats to be sort of wide open. Like, he just had a playing field for Zach to go off. There was nothing in his way as far as the beat or the bass line, but that's what made it so poignant, and things stuck out, and they really hit home. It's like, the fans, I think they're not listening to notice how, you know, syrupy smooth and silky the bass player can be on a run. I think if what it does is viscerally impact them with a beat and let the singer come through, I think, and if the singer's got the right hook or the right, you know, message, that's what resonates. And it was all such a beautiful package, that band. Always.
Absolutely. Comes. So just kind of getting back to Downset, I mean, you guys do the first album, you know, the first full-length album, and then you guys head out on tour. You know, who are the first bands you guys played with?
Yeah, it was, well, this was like just flash bang. What happened was the band got a bunch of interest. We got a manager. Then all of a sudden we were, the management had sort of given us like a demo deal, and we were pushing our demo around, and all of a sudden Mercury Records and stuff had come around. We had looked at a few labels, got signed, and out of nowhere, Biohazard, Europe, 94, with Biohazard and Doggy Dog, like straight out of the box, first tour, Europe in a bus.
Wow.
Amazing. The wall had just come down, I think, in 89, 90, so we were in Eastern Europe, ostensibly, just 4 years after, you know, their sort of quote-unquote liberation. And yeah. So you're literally seeing Europe at, like, a breakneck speed, and it was the crowds were huge. It was, you know, like thousands of kids a night. Who knew zero about Downset? I mean, hadn't even heard of it. And all of a sudden, by the end of that tour, by the end of that month, we went right back on our own and headlined clubs. And it was just like, it was on. Like, Europe just, it was on for that. That's why we did so well in Europe for so long, is that it just worked. Yeah, so that was our first tour over Biohazard and Doggy Dog, and the rest of it was just, you know, amazing.
Doggy Dog's another one of those bands, kind of underrated.
I think Doggy Dog never, you know, at least, well, especially out here on the West Coast. I know they're a lot bigger on the East Coast and maybe the Midwest, but that band was so much fun and such a great energy to them, and I'd always thought that there was just, there was something about the States that never really sort of just caught on for them. It's a shame, but, you know, I don't feel too bad because they go to Europe and headline festivals.
And then after the Biohazard tour, you stayed in Europe for a little bit, and then you come home. What do you guys do?
Well, we came back home. We did a van tour in the U.S. with, I believe it was like 108. We had some shows with 108, and we did some shows with Testament around in the van, but immediately, almost like 6 months later, after we had gone to Europe with Biohazard, we went right back with Pantera, and that was Stadium. So it was a great 1-2 punch for, like, we got in the right places at the right time, and we were exposed to so many people, and the scene was so ready to start embracing this type of music that us opening up for Pantera was, it was perfect, because you've got, like, the standard metalheads at that time, but then you've got the young kids who are like, what's this? This is new. And automatically it was just, here we go. If Biohazard wasn't enough, then look at this. And we just sort of took off really well. We were in Europe and with Pantera, and then by that time we were coming back to do festivals in Europe, and it was just sort of, the ball was on a roll. We went back there with Doggy Dog and toured again at the Crossing All Over Festival with Double War back in the day. Then we were in the States, and we were doing, like, van tours and, like, doing stuff with Hatebreed and VOD. We did the Tattoo the Earth and the Ozfest. Well, Ozfest 97 with all, you know, everybody and their mother.
That's after the second album, right? That was after the
second album. Yeah, okay, sorry. I was jumping ahead in the timeline. The first album, the great part was in Europe as far as the shows and the EU's and the adventure of it, but the States was mostly in the van, and we did, like, some stuff with Snapcase, and we just were kind of on our own, and we were just playing shows with, like, local bands and whomever. I think it was us and a band called Shooty's Groove, both on Mercury Records.
Yeah.
And
Guys are, like, just playing with, like, my entire 90s discography, pretty much. Every band you bring up, I think I own their album.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they were great bands. I mean, looking back, those...
And very diverse, too. Very diverse bands.
Yeah. Yeah, you know. They were all over the place. And so were we, because I think the object was... although hardcore was successful, it was still seen as, like, in a box, and if you were a hardcore band, you only do this level of kind of, you know, production or whatever. And I think that they wanted to get us out in front of as many types of acts and be as kind of diverse as possible, you know, to break out of the... Like, we had the hardcore box checked.
Yeah,
and we did a lot of hardcore shows. And I think that we kind of... The object with the label was to kind of spread that sort of new sound feel around the U.S. We were on the same label as the Boss Tones, and so we did a lot of shows with the Boss Tones, and that was fun. And a lot of Machine Head out here on the West Coast on that first record as well. So, yeah, those kinds of...
Do you have a good Pantera story, maybe a good Dimebag story for the podcast?
Oh, my gosh. Pantera was heavy metal summer camp. And I think that, well, one of my fondest stories now in light of circumstances was we flew from L.A. to London and had to play a show in Liverpool. The first show was in Liverpool. And we had gotten off the plane, gotten in the van or bus or whatever it was, and shown up to the gig like 45 minutes before, you know, the set. When we were heading straight off the plane, jet lag. And I remember seeing double and just kind of being blurry out of my face. and we hadn't had, we got on stage and we were like, wow, and we kind of hadn't seen Pantera yet. And it was a total sellout crowd in Liverpool. And I just remember playing a few songs and turning around, and then there's Dimebag, right, with, like, flaming pink goatee and, like, that curly mess of hair. I was like, oh, my God, that's Dimebag Darrell. And he comes up to, he goes, the whole band, like, Phil, no, not the whole band, but Phil and Dime come out on stage, and then they give a shot of Black Tooth Grin. And we hadn't even had them yet, and I was like, oh, man. And so that was just a great breaking the ice moment, like, here's me, like, you know, what am I, 19 or 20 at the time, 21 maybe, and just, wow, I'm on the stage with, like, these rock stars, and they're handing me, you know, shots of Black Tooth. I remember staying up, well, that tour actually kind of taught me how to keep up with these guys when it came to drinking, because those guys were machines, right? So I remember just, like, those guys would keep a hotel bar open till the sun came up, you know. And because it was them, it was kind of neat to see the kind of things that when you're a rock star, the kinds of rules that bend for you. Like, no one can stay in a hotel bar past its closing. They just kept it open, and they just kept being, those kinds of things were rock and roll. Just, you know, wow, that's rock and roll. Just crazy antics. Dimebag Darrell used to always like to play jokes, practical jokes, and just like pulling fire alarms and spraying us with fire extinguishers, things like that. There was a wild bunch. Those guys are great.
Unfortunately, the mess with Phil, you know, still kind of lingers around them. But obviously, growing up, I was a huge Pantera fan. So anytime I get somebody that toured with them, I always have to hit them up for a tour story.
Yes, yeah. Well, Phil was never. I mean, I know what happened with Phil in light of all that, and. You know, that happened out here in L.A., not far from where I am. But, I mean, that sucks. If, you know, someone's racist, obviously that's the wrong thing to do. But I think everyone's chimed in and given their opinion on that. The guy has always been good to me. I never saw that side of him. And I just hope the guy's okay. And, you know, I just, I miss the good times, and I hope that, you know, he corrects, if there's anything he needs to correct, then he should correct that. And I think it should be a teachable moment as far as that goes. That you are in the public eye, to any extent, you got to realize that in this day and age, it's super, super sensitive, because everything's on video, everything's being listened to, and everything's being, you know, commented on ad nauseum. So if you're a little drunk and you're with your friends and you go, hey, you know, racist comment, it's going to go across the world in a matter of 24 hours. And it wasn't funny, and it's not okay. So context, as far as, you know, knowing where you are, who you are, and what you're doing in front of, you know, what context. So, you know, just don't be stupid.
Easier said than done for most people out there. So
yeah, it's hard to self-edit. Not that he needs self-editing because he's a closet racist type of thing, but self-editing, like, everyone gets a little bit bigger than their britches when they've been drunk. You know, who's not said something stupid when they've been drunk? I think it happens, you know, all the time. So you just got to be careful. You got to be really careful and a little bit smarter and be a little bit more self-editing. So, anyways. It's a sucky thing, but I hope he learns from it, and I hope things get better.
Me too. So you guys go in to record the second album, and obviously the production from the first album to the second album just kind of goes up. I mean, what was the you know, kind of the difference in the two albums? And then, you know, is it just learning what you're doing, or is that a bigger budget? What was going on there?
The difference between the first and second album, we tracked the initial music, the bass and drums and guitars, in one studio, at the LA Studios, LA Sound Studios in Calabasas. And I think that they had a really great room and a really, really great board. And I thought that there was a little bit more, heading into the second album, there was a little bit more understanding of where the sort of playing field sort of lied. And we got a lot more honed in. We got a lot more sort of focused. And I think that second album, we all played a lot more, quote unquote. We just played our asses off a lot more. It was kind of, on the first record, it was more angular maybe, and more like chug, 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 chug. And whereas the second record was more like ding, 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 ding. You got a little bit more loose. You had a little bit more confidence all the way around from the producer, Rory D, to the band, who sort of was like, okay, what we do works. We don't know why it works, but since it works, let's have some fun with it. And I know that I definitely stretched out a lot more on the second record. There's a lot more bass lines as far as the kind of technicality things that I'm playing. And I just think that the album sounds a little bit better sonically. Ray, I think, kind of hits a nice stride. We're all adding sort of a layer to what we are from the first to the second record. And I think that songs like Empower, I Shut Tight, you know, those are really fun songs to go back and listen to. Against the Spirits, we sort of brought back that our roots on that, our like backyard hardcore roots. And we just sort of, we stepped with a little bit more confidence rather than sort of, okay, let's see what happens. We were like, okay, we know what happens when we make music. So it's kind of reflected in a sort of confidence on that record.
Yeah, I was actually going through the kind of down the rabbit hole the last few days, kind of getting prepared and just going back, listening to those first couple albums and just like, it's so funny when you don't listen to something for a while and you go back to listen to it and you, everything comes back and you're remembering lyrics and, you know, the next part, the next song. Second album is like one of those albums for me where I think I just wore that one out, you know.
Yeah, that album was the best selling of all the records. So, you know, everyone always credits Anger for, you know, Downset's Identity, but the second album had the most success, and I'm really proud of that record. And it, like you said, I think last year maybe I threw that album on for the first time ever, because I never listened to any dance. I never listened to our records at the time. I never put a Downset. See, like if it was on, if my friends were playing it, or if it came on, like I was like, that's cool. But I never sat down by myself, put on my record outside of, you know, when you make the record and you're listening to mixes, that's something else. But I never just came home and listened to my own stuff, primarily because, A, I was doing it for a living and I didn't want to hear it anymore. But B, because I was afraid that, oh, man, I might think it sucks. I'm cool that everyone else likes it, but I'm just afraid that I won't like it. Like, you know, actors don't watch their movies type of thing?
Yeah.
But like about a year ago, I threw on the second record and just sort of let it go. And I was like, whoa, I'm just listening to this. Is like six songs in. I'm like, wow, this is a really fun record. I really, really like it. And I was really proud.
That's great.
So, yeah, that just happened.
You know, just kind of going back to being the bass player and stuff like that. But, you know, going back to your bass tones on those albums are so, you know, so great. Like, you have such a good tone, you know. You're like one of the first, you were one of the first players I remember. Because, you know, back in the 90s when I was growing up, I was a big Cliff Burton fan and, you know, Geezer Butler fan, things like that. And, you know, I was like, you got to play with your fingers to play. And, you know, and then, like, I saw you live and I was like, well, you know, maybe you could play with a pick.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah, punk rock, well, at least for my roots. It all comes from a front-loaded attack with that right hand, you know, you're strumming. And I think to really dig and get sort of in the trenches of those grooves, it was really nice to have the confidence of a pick. I do play with my fingers, and a few things I did play with my fingers, but I just always found that there was a softer, more like a blurry finesse to it. And that works in some things, but for what I needed a sharp knife. And I think that's the pick helped give me as far as navigating those songs.
Yeah, that's definitely a great analogy, a sharp knife. I like that. So that album comes out and you guys do like the, you know, you do the first, you know, the first huge Ozfest. You know, what are your memories of that?
That was another great tour. I mean, it was bedlam because we've been doing European festivals, and that was really really good, and it was almost sort of a more of a, you know, naivete in Europe in the 90s. It was like, everyone jump, okay, everyone's jumping, and okay, everyone's happy. It was a lot more happier feeling and joyful at the European sort of like metal festivals. But when it came to my first American festival, which is the Ozfest, it was like you just get like this big, amped up, you know, gnarly, ready to kick ass crowd. And so we, you know, when you put together the kind of lineup that was, like Marilyn Manson, Machine Head, Pantera, Slayer, and not Slayer. That was Tattoo of the Earth. Well, I'm not sure. I'm trying to remember. Do you remember who was on that?
I don't actually.
I think it's Machine Head, Cold Chamber, Marilyn Manson, Pantera, Sabbath and Ozzy, of course, and VOD, and us, and I'm forgetting quite a few bands. Drain, STH, right. Slogan, which kind of came from that desert rock scene, like
Caius.
Caius, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But playing in an American festival was a lot more aggro and a lot more sort of like the intense vibes, and I was like, okay, I recognize this. This feels like an American audience, but just amplified like times 10. And some of those shows were just off the chain, like a riot in Columbus, Ohio. There was never riots in Europe. There was like a riot in Columbus. There was, you know, you'd see a lot of sort of casualties because there was like a lot of sort of anger out there rather than joy. When you get a big crowd of metalheads in the States, you get anger. When you get a big crowd of metalheads in Europe at the time, it was more like, yay!
And we're all together!
Yeah. It was kind of an eye-opener in that. And there was a lot, that was at the height of Marilyn Manson's sort of controversy. Yeah. So there was a tension. I guess that's what I was searching for. Because of things like the Marilyn Manson issue, everyone was sort of like, whoa, because no one knew what A, he was going to do, and B, no one knew what was around the corner as far as like the religious right or, you know, some kook trying to like cause trouble. And there was lots of threats. There was lots of, you know, bomb threats and things like that as far as, you know, that tour was fraught with a lot of like, whoa, like you really think that's going to happen? But it was great. I mean, to the point, you know, I was on stage with Sabbath for the entire summer. I was literally on Geezer's Hide listening to it. It was monumental, seeing all those bands play. The caliber of musicianship, you know, just from all the players, you just learn so much. Like Robert Trujillo just coming out and hanging out because he was playing with Ozzy at the time. Yeah. And just having him come over and be like, yeah, man, love your band. I was like, ah, I love you, man. But it was a bunch of moments like that. It was, you know, just me being in the shower at like what one of those stadiums we played in, because you had to use the team shower, right? So it's like, so your dressing room has the shower with like, you know, 20 nozzles, and you're in there showering, and then there's another dude in there showering from the road crew, like passing the soap, dude. I'm like, all right, cool, all right, I'm on the road. it was good. The food was really good. The catering was awesome.
Oh, I bet. You call home and be like, Mom, I made it.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I ever called home and said, Mom, I made it, because I always just wanted to keep humble and keep my, you know, nose to the grindstone and keep jamming. But it definitely felt like there's a few photos out there where it's just like the sea of people in front of me, and I'm like, wow. And looking back now, it feels like, wow, what a great achievement, and I made it. But at the time, it was like, you know, let's keep driving this thing. Let's keep pushing this thing uphill. I don't know if I ever had that I, quote unquote, made it moment feeling.
Yeah.
But I definitely was like, I definitely felt 15 feet tall up there. Absolutely. And I embraced that. What it did, rather than me having an I've made it moment, it sort of gave life to a side of my personality that made me larger than life and to be huge, and I just ran with it. And it's a feeling and an identity that you don't get anywhere else except on stage. And it was a healthy thing because it was fun.
Oh, absolutely. You know, from the touring that I've done in the few bands that I've been in, you know, you definitely can get out there and you can definitely feel, you know, invincible, things like that. That's what I always talk about. I've had a few conversations with, you know, guys that have had van wrecks, or, you know, not even necessarily tour, you know, actually, yeah, tour bus wrecks, you know, things like that. And you get out there and you get in the tour bus and you get in the van and, you know, you feel invincible. And then all of a sudden, you know, something like what just happened with the Ghost Inside or, you know, other bands that have, you know, had tragedies, things like that. You know, you just, you get out there and you feel invincible, and then something like that can, you know, totally derail the whole situation.
You know, the world's a scary place. And I think, you know, when you're traveling that much, you know, normally we go from, you know, home to work or work to school type of thing. But when you're in a band, you're in a different environment on a daily basis, and you're bringing a bunch of people and a bunch of equipment with you. So it's not like a small car. You're bringing like a lot of weight and material with you. So when you hit a patch of ice or bad weather, your bus goes off the side of the road, which has happened to me. You know, it's a lot more. There's a lot more opportunity for tragedy. You know, it's a trip.
Absolutely. So growing up, man, did your parents, were your parents supportive of you doing music, or were they kind of hesitant?
My mom was really supportive. My dad didn't understand it at all, I don't think. My dad was very old school. My mom was very much happy for me and supportive. And, you know, she was the one that would drive me to gigs when I was 13 and drop me off. And I'd call her and she'd come pick me up again. And thank God, because that's really, I found my sort of identity in those shows and those casinos, those bands and those early punk rock shows and early hardcore shows. And I felt like, okay, it's okay to be me and like what I like and do what I do. So yeah, mom was there, God bless her, and dad was sort of like, well, whatever, don't blame me if they beat you up because you got a mohawk.
So with Downset and kind of infusing hardcore and hip hop, do you guys take any of the credit for like the new metal sound, the rap metal sound?
Credit. I've never been asked to take credit. Do I feel like I'm responsible? I feel like we're definitely responsible for the momentum in some way. We definitely facilitated that sound. I don't know if I go so far to say like we're recognized as the arbitrators of what's good or bad, or maybe the originators. I just think that we were a very strong sort of touch point in that whole scene. A lot of those bands have given me credit. When I've met them and talked to me, they're like, you know, that first album, or when I heard Anger, or, you know, that bass line, or that guitar riff, or when that beat drops, like, that just made me want to do this and that. And I mean, a lot of those bands opened up for Downset as they were coming through, like in the LA scene, like System and Korn. And like those were just good days. And whether or not we made a tactile imprint on those people, I don't know. But I definitely think that we were in the first wave, and we were kind of the more underdog, the more like the harder hardcore sound.
Yeah.
So I think we filled out one corner of that sort of field nicely. So yeah, I would say we can take credit for being there and doing the kind of thing that sort of helped nurture a scene. Absolutely.
And then like being kind of from the punk and hardcore scene, you know, it's kind of seeing kind of where the rap metal, the new metal kind of went, to where like the, you know, the giant baggy jeans and the, you know, silly spiked hair and things like that. I mean, did you kind of look back and go like, that, you know, hopefully I didn't create that, you know?
Yeah. Well, you aren't, you can't be a dictator about your art. You whatever it spawns, you know, good or bad, that's, you know, that's kind of out of your control. If what you did was pure and good, then I sort of like said, hey, I'm not going to judge like the kid who, you know, the juggalo, because, you know, it's not me. But
yeah,
for sure, it's like, yeah, there's definitely absolutely things out there that aren't for me that I look at and go, yeah, I'm okay. But it's somebody's art. It's somebody's something. And, you know, it's it's all good. If it's for you and it's your favorite music and it's what you do and you love, then that's awesome. And if I sort of push you in a direction and to find a passion that you love and create art and do something that other people love, then that's cool too. Maybe I hate it. Maybe I don't like it at all. Yeah, there's a whole spectrum of that rap metal scene, new metal or whatever that I just wasn't into. That's not me being on my high horse or me being condescending. It's just saying I come from a certain place, and I took where I came from and I tweaked it just a little bit with four other dudes, and it came out like this. I know a lot of people heard us and were like, ugh, disgusting, you know? But a lot of people weren't. And so just like I can't paint the stripe on somebody that came after me for sort of the more clownish aspects of what, you know, hip-hop and metal became, they can't paint me with a stripe because I don't give a damn. You know, I did my thing. I did something original in some respects, and I made art. And at the end of the day, it's like no one can take that from me. So not to be too politically correct about your answer, but
no,
yeah, so I think a lot of that stuff is not for me at all. I don't like it at all. But I don't think that, ooh, I don't hang my head in shame or like, oh, sorry, guys. I'm sorry for making that, you know, come to life. Not at all. Not at all.
Well, I think still, you know, to this day, you guys could still play a hardcore festival, play with Hatebreed, play with Earth Crisis, but you could turn around and still play, you know, I don't, you know, you may or may not have, but I mean, you could play a Gathering of the Juggalos, or you could play, you know, open for Limp Bizkit, or, you know, open for Korn, any of those bands like that, and no one's ever going to bat an eye because, you know, you guys kind of slip through that to where you're still revered in the hardcore community, but you're still, you know, respected in like the, you know, the rap metal community also. So it was kind of a, you know, you guys made a nice path for yourselves.
I think so. I think we sort of slipped right down the middle on that, like you said. And that's an awesome place to be. Yeah, all good.
What's the future of Downset? Yeah, you guys do anything? Or
we're all kind of off doing our own lives. There's, you know, I've got a new band called NomCon. That's basically a backyard, like sort of hardcore. It's like 1985 LA hardcore.
And, sweet.
You know, you could find us on Facebook, NomCon LA, NomCon.
There you go.
And everyone else is kind of working their lives and doing their thing, and I don't really know if there's much going on band-wise with any of the other guys, but, you know, we're all just sort of, you know, got our lives and families and careers and whatever we're doing. So it's definitely not out of the question if, you know, Downset was to play a show or two in the future somewhere, but, I mean, I think that we're all pretty much comfortable with what we're doing in our lives, and we're really happy with what we've done. We did a record a couple of years ago, like you said, because there was a sort of album in the can that never got really released once we broke up, and we sort of went back, revisited that, and put it out on our own, just sort of as a, hey, this stuff was here. If you still like it, check it out.
Very cool, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely appreciate you taking the time today, man. This has been fun. This has been a lot of fun. And like I said, you know, just kind of coming back from, you know, being, man, I guess I was maybe 19 turning 20, I think, when we played with you guys. So it's definitely a nice time. So
it's a great full circle moment. And it's like, it's the least I can do. You guys haven't driven out 40 hours just to do that. So thank you so much for doing that. What a small world, and what a great, see, look what music has done. Like, it's brought me, you know, back to, you know, an old friend like you years later to talk about the good times we had, and to everyone listening that, you know, wasn't there, maybe it gives them sort of an insight to the oral history of that great scene of, like, rap metal, hardcore, and punk rock. And maybe it gives them inspiration to go out there and do their thing. I think it's awesome. I think that me doing something like this reminds me of hearing somebody I would look up to, like, talking about their experiences, and me being like, yeah, I want to do that too, or yeah, I want to believe in myself even that much more, because hearing them talk makes me feel like I can do it too.
Thrones wake and
And there you go, guys. That was my interview with James Morris of Downset. Thanks for James for coming on the podcast. Got a lot of great episodes coming up. Got a lot of great guests lined up. Next week on the podcast, we've got Mark Hunter of Chimera on the podcast. I've already recorded the interview. Such a great interview. I cannot wait for it to come out to you guys, and I know you guys will totally enjoy it. So one last final plea to you guys. Please go get yourself a Talk To Me t-shirt on Amazon.com. And then please, please, please go to iTunes, rate and review the podcast. Get those reviews up. Get those ratings up. I've got like five-star reviews on iTunes and only 3 reviews. And I think one of those reviews is from me. So that's pretty ridiculous. So I'm going to read those next week. So make sure, share the podcast when you see it pop up on Facebook, when you see it pop up on Twitter. And then also, go to iTunes, rate and review the podcast. We're going to have a lot of fun reading those next week. And I'm going to read off the names of the people who have shared the podcast over the week. It's going to be great. Going to have a lot of fun. A lot of great stuff coming up. Like I said, next week, Mark Hunter, Chimera. But I'm going to leave you guys this week with some non-con, N-O-N-C-O-N. Make sure to go and support them. It's James's band that he's currently in. You know, doing some great stuff out there in L.A. Got a track coming up for you right now by them. So I'm going to leave you with some non-con. Hope you guys have a great week. And for the Talk To Me podcast, I am Joshua Toomey. Have a great week, guys.